You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So good morning, everybody. My name is Amadou C, and I serve as the Director of the Africa Growth Initiative here at Brookings, AGI. We're happy to have you here with this very nice, decent British weather. So to know more about our work on Africa, I encourage you to have a look at our website. We are happy today to host an excellent panel to discuss Africa's agenda for industrialization. The event is timely as African delegations are arriving in town for the IMF World Bank spring meetings. So again, thank you for coming. We know that there's a lot of events going on, so we appreciate that you come to this one. But these meetings are happening against the background of slow economic growth and a difficult external environment. In particular, commodity prices have fallen significantly, and most experts now agree that the new normal is a low for long scenario for commodity prices. And this is, of course, important for Africa, because if you take the oil exporters, Angola, Cameroon, Chad, Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, Nigeria, and South Sudan, you have about half of the region's GDP. So African policymakers are working on how to manage these external shocks. And if you read recent budget speeches, such as the one given by President Buhari of Nigeria, of Minister Gordon of South Africa, who, by the way, will be here Thursday at 8 a.m., so if you have some time, we'll be happy to have you again. You will see that diversification of the economy is really a common theme. And so this is important to build more resilient economies. Our own econometric work shows that about half of the growth that we see these days in Africa is driven by external factors. But it's also important to create jobs. It's also important to absorb the youth bulge and reduce poverty. So John Page today and our esteemed panelists will discuss how industrialization can be an important part of Africa's structural transformation. The debate will be informed by the findings of a multi-year joint project of the Africa Growth Initiative with the United Nations University World Institute for Development Economics Research, also known as UNIWIDER. And that project is called the Learning to Compete Project. So findings of the L2C project are condensed in a new book entitled Made in Africa, Learning to Compete in Industry, which is available outside the room. And more details, if you are into research, are available in a series of working papers that are available on the UNIWIDER website, and we will also make them available on our website. So let me now introduce John, and it's an honor to do so. John is the former chief economist for Africa and director poverty reduction at the World Bank. He's a research associate of the Center of the Study of African Economies at Oxford University and the Oxford Center for the Study of Resource-Rich Economies. I know that John works also on the Japanese economy, so I always feel jealous when he takes the plane to go to Japan, but hopefully we have him today. John, please. Thank you.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming out on a miserable morning in Washington at a relatively early hour. You might have noticed something already, which is that one of our panelists had a bit of travel trouble this morning. So we've done something which some of my colleagues at Brookings say is rather a challenge for us, which is we've gone into the 21st century, and behind me, looking over my shoulder, is Margaret McMillan, who will join us thanks to the magic of our IT people. Maggie, can you hear me? I guess not, but we'll see as we go along. Actually, this might be a real virtue. I can say all kinds of things. We have a very, very distinguished group of people here today to talk about the question of industrialization in Africa. And when Finn Tarp and I, together with the African Development Bank, began asking ourselves the question of why there was so little industry in Africa, which was actually around 2010, it seemed that very few other people were really concerned about it. And that certainly has changed. Industry is now on the agenda of African policymakers, of African research institutions, of African governments. And if I just recollect, in the last 12 months, we've had initiatives by the African Union, by the Economic Commission for Africa, by UNIDO, and by national governments to bring industry to the center stage, where, frankly, it hasn't been for about 40 years. So one of the things that we wanted to accomplish in the work on learning to compete was to try to understand why industry had failed to plant itself on the African continent and what could be done about it. And so we began learning to compete with a commitment to involve national researchers and national think tanks. And for that, I would like to recognize the close participation and collaboration of the 11 country-based teams of researchers who are really at the heart of this research. We also wanted to do things a little bit differently from many, let's call them standard economic research projects. We not only wanted to do the normal econometric work and to some extent some qualitative work, but we also wanted country studies. We wanted to understand what the history of industrialization had been. And in the course of that history of industrialization, what the effect of policies, good and bad, might have been in Africa's industrialization story. We also wanted some comparative understanding. So in addition to looking at 9 countries south of the Sahara, we also undertook to look at 2 countries in East Asia, Vietnam and Cambodia, which are emerging tigrettes, I guess one could call them, and Tunisia in the north of Africa, which has been arguably one of the 2 industrial success stories on the continent. The book that we're here to launch today, and my friend Sir Paul Collier always reminds me that you never have a public event without making a shameless book plug, this book is called Made in Africa. And we've somewhat humorously referred to it, basically in his honor, as our airport book. The reason why is not because we thought it would ever be something that was so popular people would actually buy it in airports, unlike his famous book, The Bottom Billion. But we hope that it would be the sort of book that a busy permanent secretary might read on an airplane while he was flying to a meeting somewhere and get a sense of what we thought we had learned from this project and get a sense of the kinds of changes in public policy we hoped governments would be making if they wished to industrialize. And I have a success case to report. I just returned from Dar es Salaam over the weekend. And while I was there, I had a chance to have a chat with Professor Adolf Makenda, who is the Permanent Secretary for Trade and Investment in the Ministry of Industry, Trade and Investment of Tanzania. And he mentioned to me that, lo and behold, he had bought the book on Amazon and read it on an airplane between one set of meetings and another. So I've at least accomplished one success for the airport book. And so while we will talk a bit about the book, and I'm certainly going to task Finn Tarp, one of our co-authors, to tell you what he thinks are the main messages of the book, we want to have a broader conversation, and that's why we've brought the panel together that we have here today. Let me just try to briefly introduce each of them, beginning on my immediate left, with Governor Benno Ndulu of the Bank of Tanzania. One thing you will notice about Governor Ndulu is that his biography, in the ones we've distributed to you, is the shortest of any of the participants. This is, I think, a reflection on his modesty and certainly not on the accomplishments that he's had in a long and distinguished career of public service in Africa. To mention just a few of the highlights of his career, after getting his PhD at Northwestern and surviving the Chicago winters, he returned to Tanzania to become a member of the faculty at the University of Dar es Salaam, where he was a professor for many years. He then moved on to the Africa Economic Research Consortium, where he was the executive director of the AERC, which many of us regard as one of the most successful cases of institution and capacity building in Africa. From there, he moved to a period of time at the World Bank, where he and I actually had the privilege of working together in the Africa Vice Presidency of the World Bank. He is an advisor to the Vice President and me as the Chief Economist. And then from there, back to Tanzania to become first Deputy Governor and then Governor of the Bank of Tanzania. He has been very much engaged in making economic policy and certainly in the conduct of economic and monetary policy, not just in Tanzania alone, but also in the East African community. So a long and very, very distinguished career of public service and of academic excellence. Next to him is Professor Finn Tarp, who is director of UNU WIDER and professor and coordinator of the Development Economics Research Group at the University of Copenhagen. Finn is really a leading international expert on aid effectiveness development strategy. But he has also worked extensively on poverty, on income distribution, on growth, and as you've seen laterally, on industry and on the relationship between those. And I hope in the course of our discussion he can talk a bit about how we see the relationship between industrial development and poverty, which on the face of it, many of you might think, maybe not so intimately connected. He also was knighted by the Queen of Denmark in November of last year. My only regret is, unlike in England, the Danes are sufficiently modest so that we can't use that in the publicity for the book and call him Sir Finn Tarp, but clearly a recognition of his service both to the Danish state and to economics more broadly. I'll introduce Kapil Kapoor, and then I'll get back to Margaret McMillan if we can get her back on the screen. Kapil is the acting vice president for sector operations and director of strategy and operational policy at the African Development Bank Group in Abidjan. He's led the preparation of the new African Development Bank strategy for transformation of Africa over the next decade, so deeply engaged in thinking about how the AFDB relates to the challenges of transformation and diversification in Africa's economies. He also led the preparation of the bank's private sector development strategy, so has a lot of insights into what the bank is trying to do on the private sector as well. As I said, the AFDB was a very valuable partner in this undertaking, responsible for conducting a number of the country studies and a number of the other econometric studies. So I hope that he has the capacity and the mandate to tell us a little bit about how this work might affect the way in which the bank thinks in terms of its longer-term strategy for private sector development. Before he joined the African Development Bank Group, he was a senior official at the World Bank. Finally, our absent partner, Margaret McMillan, now I can say almost anything I like about her, but I won't. Maggie's professor of economics at Tufts University. She's a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, and a research associate of the NBER's Program on International Trade and Investment. Her research, which is quite extensive and very widely and well published, is generally in the areas of international trade, investment, enterprise, and development. At the moment, she's engaged in two quite large projects designed to track the impact of Chinese and other foreign direct investments on the manufacturing sector in Africa. And so I hope that either during the discussion or during the questions and answers, some of us might be able to ask her a bit about what is the role of China in industrializing Africa. She holds a PhD from Columbia University, an MPA from Princeton, and a BA in mathematics and economics from Boston University. So those are our panelists. As you can see, they're quite a varied and also quite a knowledgeable group. And what I will ask each of them to do, beginning at my left with Professor Ndulu, is to give us about 5 minutes of remarks on sort of key themes that they want to bring to the table today. Then we'll take about a half an hour of having a discussion, which I'll attempt to moderate. I've cribbed a few questions, but some others may come up in the course of the discussion. And then, ideally, we should still have about 30 minutes time left for questions and answers from the floor before we have to close. So without any further remarks from the chair, I'd like to turn it over to Professor Ndulu. Benno?
Well, thank you very much. You know, just to start with applause to the book. For sure, I'm going to get a few copies myself. I know I'll read only one. Yeah. About 2 years ago, we had this very big meeting. The title was Africa Rising. And, you know, optimism was extremely high, and I think there was very good reason for it. Hardly 2 years later, I think people are rushing too quickly to find the pessimism that had disappeared for a while, and everybody talks about how the end of the commodity boom will set Africa back to its former history. I think there are quite a few things that have happened in between in the last 2 decades that people need to take into account. I won't have very much time for that, partly so that I can come back to the main topic of the day here. But one, commodity was not the whole story about Africa Rising. And in fact, more than two-thirds of the countries in the region that had posted very rapid growth were not driven by commodities. And secondly, even for those countries where commodities were important, including, for example, Nigeria, you know, commodity is very big in exports. But in Nigeria, commodity is not as big in GDP. And people tend to forget that. And growth is not about exports only. And thirdly, I think what people also have tended to forget is that services is a very big part of GDP in that region. And for a whole range of countries, more than half of the GDP actually comes from services. The fastest growing sectors have been in services, not just public administration, it's communication services, it's banking and financial services. These are the most rapid growing sectors in most of the countries. So while definitely it is very important that we focus on transformation for sustainability, I thought I would use part of my 5 minutes just to put that sound bite so that people don't rush too quickly to throw hands up in the air and say, there, the region goes again. Okay. Now, it's very important that Africa pursues a transformation strategy. Diversification ultimately will underline sustainability of Africa's growth. Now, there are three main features I would like to mention by way of sound bites of a transformation strategy. First, one, exploit Africa's comparative advantage in natural resources to support transformation. Definitely, the region has a strong comparative advantage in natural resources, and the way to make use of that is partly to pursue natural resource-based industrialization, and this includes exploiting industrial minerals and gas to energy and energy to support industry. Agro-processing, given that agriculture and land, one of the largest resources the region has, and agro-industrialization. All these are part of the natural resource-based industrialization feature. But also, under natural resources, exploit revenue from natural resource to finance transformation rather than to finance consumption. And this has to be part of the larger transformation strategy. Now, second, we need a job-creating transformation. It's not just any transformation. And for that, Africa should be able to exploit its comparative advantage in youthful and potentially low-cost labor. You know, the youthfulness of demography of Africa is not necessarily a curse. It can be harnessed really to drive growth and to support particularly labor-intensive industrialization. Justin Lin talks about 85 million jobs ready to move from China to the rest of the world as China's labor becomes more costly. Africa has got to position itself to get a fair share or a large share of that kind of jobs, but must be ready to compete. And here, I think the importance of this book is very, very clear. So labor is not enough. You need skills and employability. Even where you have skills, you need to match skills to the demand for those skills. It's very often we have had situations where firms are looking for skills, and there are skills that are looking for jobs, and the two don't match. And therefore, it is very important we go beyond simply training, and also to reduce transaction costs. Lastly, exploit Africa's potential as an enlarged market to support manufacturing for domestic consumption, including producing those products that are peculiar to the consumption pattern of the region. And there are lots of those. You know, yams are not the most popular in other parts of the world, but we do know you can produce a whole range of products that would be popular in that region. Now, I'm saying this partly because the region in the last two decades has really enlarged in terms of its market size. Today, Africa's PPP GDP is $5.5 trillion. If we integrate it, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. This is a fact. Also, the region boasts of the fastest growing middle class, and right now about 60% of Africa's population lives in middle-income countries. Believe it or not, a lot has happened in between. And finally, also the region now boasts of the most rapid rate of urbanization, which, while has its own challenges, creates a demand pattern to support industrialization, and in the course of that, also learn how to compete. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Now I've tasked Fintarp with the incredibly difficult task of trying to summarize 4 years of research in 5 minutes. But he's up to the job. He's a knight. So,
Finn. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here today, and I really am very pleased to be sitting here next to Governor Ndulu, who has for more than 30 years been one of my inspirations in the work that I'm doing, and I appreciate this very much. Let me also express my gratitude to our moderator, John Page, to the Brookings Institute and the Africa Growth Initiative, and to the African Development Bank for productive collaboration over the past 5 years on what has become known as the L2C, Learning to Compete, project, which was an acronym that John, of course, came up with. It really has been quite sort of an ambitious undertaking. And I should say that it has produced quite a large amount of material. I mean, it ranges from the book that we are launching today, Made in Africa, to volumes that are forthcoming with Oxford University Press, and to articles also in top academic journals, and further on to a whole series of policy briefs. So while you may only get a few sort of glimpses today, there is actually material to consult later on. And for some of us, it's actually good to have this material at hand. Benno once made the remark that one of the advantages of being an academic is that you travel around with your knowledge in your head. So it's much easier than with big suitcases. But some of us have this sort of necessity to consult the written stuff as well. Now, we have also held quite a number of high-profile conferences, both at Uniwide in Helsinki and elsewhere, including, for example, Hanoi and Maputo. And we've had policy seminars in all regions of the world, and they've been quite numerous. So there is a lot of material available which can be consulted. In total, 11 detailed comparative country case studies of industrialization and the evolution of public policies, and 9 cases are from Africa: Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Mozambique, Nigeria, Senegal, Tanzania, Tunisia, and Uganda. And 2 cases, as John already mentioned, are from Asia, Vietnam, and Cambodia. My own sort of insight into this in particular comes from Mozambique and from Vietnam, 2 countries where I've spent about something like 14 years together, so that at least provides a little bit of my background to this. And what we've done in the process is that we've tried to take stock of, but we also tried to sort of develop the existing econometric knowledge emerging from firm-level surveys. We have tried to do our best effort to try to actually bring together a rather dispersed set of pieces of data and information and tried to tease out what we believe you can say. But we have also added a whole series of qualitative surveys of FDI firms and linked domestic enterprises. So we've sort of been trying, on the one hand, to be tough data crunchers, but at the same time, also try to ask the qualitative questions. And it's sort of the volume, as John has already pointed out, that's being launched today tries to synthesize this Made in Africa. I'd like to add my appreciation along the ones that John already did to the research team. It's actually a group of more than 100 colleagues from all around the world, and it is quite an impressive group, ranging from teams for each country, but also going beyond. So this is not just a project that has been implemented with people from the outside. It actually has had country teams based in the countries and trying to contribute their insights. As one of the sort of authors, co-authors of the Made in Africa, I wish to express my gratitude for all of this work. John Page and I, we've over the years met quite frequently at the semi-annual research workshops at the African Economic Research Consortium that Benno led for many years. And about 6 years ago, we started an intensive dialogue which gradually tuned in on the following questions. Why is there so little industry in Africa? Does it matter? Is it realistic for Africa to attempt to break into global markets in manufacturing? And what are the policy options available to African governments? Now, this sort of type of approach fitted quite well with the work program at the time that UNUWIDA was grappling with, because we very deliberately decided that we were going to try to ask some of the bigger questions in development. I mean, development economics has tended to become quite micro-focused, which is fine, but there are also some big questions out there that policymakers need to address, and we were sort of thinking that this would be one of the areas that one should dig into. Now, John and I have both worked on and in Africa for almost 4 decades from different starting points and platforms, and sort of gradually the idea of the Learning to Compete project matured. Now, so what did we find? Well, first and foremost, that sub-Saharan Africa began its post-independence economic development with a strong commitment to industry. There was a very strong commitment, but in fact, Africa has deindustrialized. The region's inability to industrialize is partly due to bad luck. For me, this is most clearly illustrated by the case of Mozambique, which was physically destroyed in the 1980s due to a devastating war. I once interviewed the former Minister of Foreign Affairs of South Africa, and he sort of said, well, yeah, there was one thing he did regret, and that was that they had destroyed Mozambique. There really was no need for that. That was the 1980s. That was pretty unlucky for Mozambique. And just to make the point even clearer, I was analyzing a whole series of plans for updating, for renovating the Mozambican cashew industry, which was sabotaged the same day when we signed the big international contract for the renovation. So there was a lot of bad luck involved. And in terms of trade shocks and economic crisis of the 1980s, brought two decades of macroeconomic stabilization, trade liberalization, and privatization. So when sort of Africa reemerged around the turn of the 21st century, African industry was no longer competing with a high-wage industrial north. It was competing with Asia. So you could argue that from the point of view of industrial development, the timing of the region's economic decline and recovery was certainly unlucky, to say the least. I think it's also fair to say that the inability to industrialize has also been due to bad policy. I mean, the Made in Africa volume highlights the remarkable similarity in the policies for industrial development followed by countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We've seen state-led import substitution. We've seen very orthodox structural adjustment. And we've seen somewhat narrow-minded reform of the investment climate being pushed. And none of these policy regimes have really succeeded in sparking dynamic industrial growth. Now, what we were aiming to do with the Made in Africa was to try to help provide a diagnosis of the present situation, and we do argue that Africa can indeed break into global markets. Governor Ndula has already highlighted some of the key points. But it does require new thinking, both in Africa and among its development partners. One of the unifying themes in the eight sub-Saharan African country case studies is the predominant role of donor-driven investment climate reforms. The Made in Africa volume points out that not much more is needed than regulatory reform. There's a sort of strange parallel here to the discussions in the 1980s about getting prices right. I mean, it's a good thing to get prices right, but that's only one of the things that you need to do. Getting regulatory reforms right is fine. You should do it. But you have to have a much broader approach and understanding of the many complexities involved in actually getting going. So what are some of the strong recommendations that we point to? Well, that there is a need for an export push type approach, such as the ones undertaken by, for example, Cambodia, Tunisia, and Vietnam. That policies designed to promote the formation of industrial clusters can be very helpful, noting that spatial policies are complementary to both the export push and a strong need for capability building initiatives across the board. But also, that there is a need for high-level government commitment to the promotion of foreign direct investment and the building of better investment promotion institutions. One shouldn't be naive about FDI, but it is important to recognize that if you get it right, then both the finance and the technology and knowledge that can be developed through these linkages can be very important in getting going. I think maybe the most important message is that it really is not enough just to do these things individually. You have to somehow try to avoid doing it piecemeal. Otherwise, African economies will not get above that important threshold, which we have seen, for example, Vietnam getting above, where things start then to moving strongly forward in a self-reinforcing manner. So I think it's correct to say that the core message is that Africa can and will have to learn to compete once donors and policymakers accept the need for a very comprehensive strategy for industrial development and actually follows it up with very specific measures in practice to make this happen. But it can be done, and I think it's important for all of us to accept that when grappling with some of these bigger issues, you cannot always get things very precisely right, but it is probably a good idea to grapple with these big questions and getting it approximately right rather than precisely wrong. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Finn. Were she sitting here, Margaret McMillan would be the next speaker. I see she's now beamed in over my left shoulder again. I feel like I'm on the Starship Enterprise. but let's see if it works. I'm going to turn to Maggie and ask her for 5 minutes or so of remarks.
Okay, can you hear me?
We certainly can.
Oh, wow, that's great. I can't hear myself. So just to make this a bit lively, I'm going to disagree with Finn about this idea that Africa is deindustrializing. And my main message this morning is that by many measures, African manufacturing is on an upswing. And as I see it, manufacturing is set to continue to expand. Why do I say this? Well, let me give you some highlights. So manufacturing exports to the continent are growing. Between 2005 and 2014, the value of manufactured exports from African countries to the rest of the world doubled in value, increasing from around $30 billion mm-hmm. to $60 billion. Of these manufacturing exports, intra-African exports are becoming increasingly important. Mm-hmm. In other words, production for domestic markets is picking up. Now, I find this really, really exciting. And as an aside, I've been supported very much in my work by the International Food Policy Research Institute and by the IGC under the auspices of John. I was in Dar es Salaam in January, and I wanted to see for myself what was going on in terms of manufacturing. So I went to the grocery store and I took about 50 photos of things said to be manufactured in Tanzania, from white dent toothpaste to Chemicotex toothbrushes to fruit juices to plastic bags and containers. It's so many items. But then, so that was interesting and surprising to me, because I had lived in Tanzania from 89 to 92, and I had never seen anything like it before. And then separately, John and I were asked by the African Center for Economic Transformation, we were asked by Yaa Ansu to help prepare a background note on manufacturing for a conference they just hosted in Rwanda, studying, designed to get policymakers together to talk about manufacturing, the importance of it, and where it's going, and how to help it to grow. And in that policy memo, we were provided a lot of data by Dirk Willem Tavella from the Overseas Development Institute. And what was most fascinating about the data is that it showed this trend in manufacturing exports, upward trend, but it also showed the increasing importance of domestic markets. So the value of manufactured exports from African countries to other African countries went from around $9 billion in 2005 to a little over $30 billion in 2014. So, in other words, these exports increased by more than 200%. I think this is interesting and important for two reasons. First, domestic demand is bound to continue to grow given the low per capita income levels in most African countries. And this means that the product for these markets will expand for several years to come. Second, most of this manufacturing appears to be driven by domestically owned firms. And maybe Benno can speak to this, but a great example of this in Tanzania is this company called Chemicotex, which was founded in 1970, but only in 2009 did it start exporting to the Democratic Republic of Kenya, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, South Africa, and Zambia. This company, started by building its transportation networks in Tanzania. It had 12, has 12 branches and distribution centers, and it distributes to almost 10,000 customers every week. And their exports to countries in Africa outside Tanzania are growing quite a bit. And the level of exports to the rest of the world, off the continent, has increased, but not by nearly as much. Now, Ethiopia is an interesting contrast, where manufacturing exports are primarily dominated by exports to markets outside the continent. And part of the reason for this growth in exports from Ethiopia, although the growth has not been phenomenal by any stretch of the imagination, is partly been led by foreign direct investment from China, Turkey, and Europe. Notably, not much investment at all from the United States. So, the extent to which this type of export platform FDI will continue to grow is a big question mark. Now, there's a woman named Helen Hai who's UNITA's goodwill ambassador to Africa. She is Chinese. She set up a shoe manufacturing company in Ethiopia. She set up her own garment manufacturing company in Rwanda, and she believes that this type of foreign direct investment is likely to continue to grow from China to Africa, for two reasons. One is the high wages and the increasing wages in China, but also, so manufacturing is slowing down in China. But she also, I also believe that there are strong geopolitical reasons for this sort of foreign direct investment to continue to increase. China and India are in competition, head-to-head competition, and anything China can do in Africa to outpace, India's growth in manufacturing, I think it will do. So I do think there's some room for optimism on that front, but I think there's less certainty about that type of investment. Now, the last point I want to make is that it has to do with employment in manufacturing. And this too has grown rapidly. So in 2005, again, the numbers we have show that there were 10 million people in Africa, in African countries engaged in manufacturing. By 2014, there were a little over 19 million employees in the manufacturing, so people working in the manufacturing sector. But these numbers, if that was all the formal manufacturing sector, then we would have seen even greater growth in manufacturing for export. But the truth is that only 6% of the employment in manufacturing in Ethiopia, for example, is in the formal sector. In Tanzania, 22% of the employment in manufacturing is in the formal sector. So the bottom line is that much of this employment growth in manufacturing is actually taking place in the informal sector. That does not have to be a bad thing. Some of the much more in-depth work that I'm doing in Tanzania shows that using nationally representative firm-level data for the informal manufacturing sector in Tanzania, we've shown that there's an enormous amount of productive heterogeneity among these firms. And I think, it's going to be extremely important going forward to integrate some of the best of these firms into the formal manufacturing process, integrate them with the larger manufacturing firms, because if this doesn't happen, then we're not, building a strong indigenous private sector in Tanzania, or and this issue about the informal sector is not just true for Tanzania, it's true for the other countries in Africa that I've worked on. I think that's more than 5 minutes, John.
Thank you, Maggie. finally, certainly but not least, Kapil Kapoor.
Thanks very much, John. When John introduced me in the very beginning, he talked about the fact that I'd led the preparation of a long-term 10-year strategy for the African Development Bank. Well, about 6-7 months ago, when our new president was elected to office, one of the first questions he asked was, the strategy is all fine, but what are the 4 or 5 key areas that we really want to prioritize and scale up? And if some of you who've heard him Since then, this agenda has become known popularly as the High Five Agenda, of which industrialized Africa is one of them. So I will come to that in a minute. But you just heard maybe what might appear to be two conflicting points of view over here, but actually they're very consistent, right? It's not as if things are not happening on the continent. A lot is happening on the continent. A lot of growth is taking place in manufacturing. But the fact of the matter is that manufacturing in Africa just accounts for less than 2% of global manufacturing and has been at that rate for well over a decade. And surely there is something wrong with that. And so that is why when we talk about the need to industrialize Africa, we are looking at that in a much broader context of, as you mentioned, the need to create jobs. I mean, just to give you an example, Africa needs to create about 11 million well-paid, productive jobs a year. It's only doing about 3 million a year right now. So the gap is about 8 million. Now, that doesn't mean that people are not getting some sort of employment. They are employed in the informal sector, as was mentioned. They are employed in agriculture. But if you're talking about well-paid, sort of consistent jobs, the employment gap's about 8 million, which means over a decade, that's about 80 million jobs that the continent needs to create. And are they going to be the jobs that, as Justin Lin says, will leave China and come to Africa? There are many countries in the world competing for those jobs, so Africa needs to compete for those jobs. And so it's taking all of these into account that we've just come up as a bank with the new strategy for industrializing Africa, which actually relies quite heavily on the recommendations of this book, which will be discussed at our annual meetings in Lusaka in May, and Paul Collier, John, and others will be there to help discuss both this book and our industry strategy in Lusaka. What is it that our strategy aims to do to try and operationalize some of these things that we talk about? So firstly, there is a realization that there are a lot of structural challenges that Africa faces in its bid to industrialize the continent. Okay? We talked about the policy regulatory environment, but there are also significant infrastructure constraints, which any survey that you talk to, any private sector company that you talk to will pinpoint infrastructure right up there. And even within infrastructure, one of the key constraints to industrialization is the lack of energy. I mean, you have countries on the continent where the access to energy is less than 5%, right? I mean, how do you talk about industrializing the continent if on average 30% of your population continent-wide or less than 40% has access to energy? And that's why one of the five priorities that we are pushing is Light Up and Power Africa, which means we need about $60 to $90 billion a year just to meet that one constraint, which is a constraint on the infrastructure side, one sub-constraint, right? There are many other constraints that Africa faces, but that's just the energy constraint to try and help industrialize Africa. A second, we talked about comparative advantage, certainly extractive, but, you know, we are focusing a lot of attention on the agriculture sector. A second priority is Feed Africa. And to me, this whole area of agriculture, agro-industrialization as a stepping stone to industrialization is something whose time has really come right now. And the reason I say that is we all know that about 70% of the population of the continent relies upon agriculture. But the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of these jobs are subsistence jobs. People are just treating agriculture not as a business, but as a way of life. It's something to fall back upon. And that's the transformation, you know, that's the mental mindset that we are trying to change through our Feed Africa strategy, which is actually very closely linked to the work that we are doing on industrialization. Because I think one of the biggest areas, one of the most promising areas that lends itself for industrialization in Africa is the agricultural sector. So yes, the policy environment. Yes, the access to infrastructure, access to markets. I mean, we tend to talk about Africa as one giant entity, but the fact of the matter is we're actually dealing with 54 countries which are very, very different. On the one hand, you have success stories for industrialization like Tunisia, which was mentioned. You also have countries like Kenya, where manufacturing GDP went up by 180% in less than 5 years. So it can be done. But then you've got other countries on the continent which are really lagging behind, where per capita manufacturing GDP is $100. Right? The average for the continent per capita manufacturing GDP is about $700. Compare that to about $3,500 for Asia or $2,500 for Latin America. There are countries in Africa where per capita manufacturing GDP is $100. So there's a long, long way to go. So yes, policies, infrastructure, access to markets. The next one's access to finance. The vast majority of the population which works on the sort of in the private sector on the continent is unbanked. These are largely informal establishments. Africa has roughly 50 million small and medium enterprises, most of which don't have access to finance. So these are the kind of sort of structural constraints that we are trying to battle with when we talk about industrializing Africa. Yes, there are many positive factors. I mean, people talked about urbanization. 40% of the continent is urbanized. So that's something that is optimistic, but also can be a time bomb. The young population of the continent, a huge source of optimism, but yet again, a huge challenge as well. So I think there's a lot of very positive things happening on the continent, a lot of very positive, specific examples that you can pick to say, hey, this is great. But when you step back and look at it continent-wide, a lot of very daunting challenges as well. And what we've tried to do is pull these things together into a document on industrializing Africa, which we hope to launch in May. What frightens me personally when we have these conversations is just the scale of what we are talking about, right? So earlier in my conversation, I talked about infrastructure challenges, and we talked about energy. You're going to require, as I said, in that one area, $60 to $90 billion. Far more than the capacity of all the multilaterals, all the bilaterals combined. Much of these resources are not going to come from FDI. Much of these resources are not going to come from the donors. They're going to come from within Africa, from within the governments, from within the private sector on the continent. And that's where we've got to focus on. The same thing applies on agriculture, $30 to $40 billion a year that's needed, right? So the financial ask is huge. The need for coordination among the multiple players that are involved, whether it is the World Bank, the African Development Bank, the bilaterals, the private sector, they're huge. Everyone's doing a little bit of very interesting work. The question is, how does it all come together and how do we pull it together to what? I mean, I think everyone agrees on the objective. No one denies that there is a need to industrialize Africa. No one denies that there's a need to feed Africa. No one denies that there's a need to light up and power Africa. But despite all that goodwill in the world, the key challenge is how do we come together and collectively channel our energies into providing the resources, both human, technical, financial, into helping Africa achieve what it really wants to do. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Kapil. I'm very conscious of the fact that you've invested on this rather rainy day to come in, and I want to get you into the conversation. But I also want to amortize my investment on some questions for the panel. So what I'm going to do is just ask each one of the panelists one question, see if I can get them to give a relatively brief answer, and then we'll take the remainder of the time to actually invite questions and answers from the floor. So let me start with Governor Ndulu. And Governor Ndulu warned us not to prematurely expect the demise of the African growth miracle as a result of the changing circumstances in the world economy. But clearly all of us, including those of us who look at our 401k accounts and other things, are a little bit worried about the state of the global economy. And I wonder, Benno, if you'd share with us some thoughts perhaps on, while it's premature to declare doom, quite clearly, you, your colleagues in central banks, your colleagues in government must be thinking about, do we need to make some strategic shifts now? Do we need to respond to this in some way beyond what business as usual has been? And I suspect everyone in the room would love to hear, if you've got some insights into that, where you think governments and central banks may be going over the next few years if we are, in fact, confronted with a slowdown in the global economy.
Yeah, I think one of the key challenges that is keeping a lot of us sleepless relates partly to this big drive of investment in infrastructure. You know, everybody and for a good reason, pushes that particular line. But I'm willing to bet that in the next 5 years to 6 years, the region will face with two major challenges related to that. One is currency mismatch, and the other one is maturity mismatch. We know infrastructure largely is non-tradable. We're financing that with a lot of short to medium-term credit, whether it's Eurobond issuance or any of the other medium-term credit. The revenue stream from this is all in local currency, whether it's power, it's telecoms. But you have to service your debt in foreign currency. And very soon, you know, the real constraint won't just be whether you are solvent enough to pay your debts, but whether you are liquid enough in terms of foreign currency to meet your obligations. And that's why I think the theme in the book on the export push is exactly the right theme that needs to be pursued. We tend to forget this. On the maturity side, we know infrastructure pays off in a lot longer period, and most likely for a number of countries, the obligations to service that debt arrive before the impacts arrive. And somehow that tends to be a little bigger problem, partly it may lead to solvency issues. So I think we have got to focus our minds exactly in getting the export part of the push very, very, very clear, because ultimately it can prove to be the very point of undoing all the good things that are being done. So we know it's very important to get that infrastructure right and the investment there, but it has to be done in a manner and with the financial packages which make sense. Sometimes we tend to forget that. So I think I would have spoken even on behalf of my colleagues in the same job I have. We all spend sleepless nights thinking about that.
Thank you, Governor. One of the happy tasks of being the moderator is to be able to actually jump around. And I want to come back to Kapil Kapoor on this point, because he mentioned to you the extraordinary size of the infrastructure gap and the banks, the African banks' commitment to try to close it. I just wanted to ask you, Kapil, two things. First of all, how is the bank trying to deal with the gap between aspirations, what people want to have in terms of infrastructure, and resources? And secondly, are there any new ideas in terms of financial engineering or teaming with the private sector that are coming out that could help solve some of the issues that the governor has raised? Because some of us over the years have written, for example, about the fact that much of the paid-up capital of the regional development banks could be used in one way or another, perhaps, to ease the nightmares that the central bank governors are having with respect to term and tenor of borrowing for infrastructure development.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a growing realization among all the banks, the World Bank, Regional Bank, that it's not so much about our own financing, but in terms of what we can do to leverage and crowd in financing. And therefore, a lot of discussion right now that's taking place is about the kind of instruments that we can put on the table which will attract capital from outside. But having said that, I mean, I think this issue of currency mismatch and maturity mismatch is an extremely important one, and one that we are focusing on quite a bit. And I think central to this whole discussion is how are governments utilizing their own resources. As you know, on average, Africa has made a lot of progress in terms of domestic resource mobilization, but there is a long way to go. Large segments of the economy remain untaxed because of underdeveloped markets and so forth. And there's a huge push being made to look at things like, you know, simplifying tax codes, strengthening tax administration, how do you fix sort of the illicit financial flows that are taking place? Because if you start controlling that, the amount of domestic capital that becomes available to finance infrastructure needs, I think, grows up pretty significantly. Also, if you look at within the continent, sovereign wealth funds and pension funds, we are increasingly beginning to have conversations with African-based pension funds who are saying that their maturity profiles are looking for investments in African infrastructure. And so the conversation really is about saying, how do we take these trillions of dollars, actually, which are available and which are not yet concentrating and focusing on the infrastructure sector, and make the environment conducive by de-risking some of these investments. So that's another area that we're focusing on. Yet another one is the domestic, sort of the development of the domestic capital markets themselves. How do you mobilize domestic savings within the continent and provide them with avenues for investment in infrastructure? Because I completely agree that you cannot finance African infrastructure on the basis of short-term foreign borrowing. It's a recipe for disaster. And the kind of scale that we are talking about does not lend itself for that sort of thing.
Thanks, Kapil. I'm going to leave the last word to Maggie because she is sort of looming over my left shoulder and come back to Finn Tarp. Finn began his professional life with a passion for agriculture, and he spent an enormous amount of time thinking about agriculture. So it's a little bit ironic that he finds himself in a panel on industrialization. But the question I wanted to ask Finn is, in a world of limited resources and limited policy attention, now that industry is back on the radar screen, must it be an either-or proposition in terms of agricultural development and improving agricultural productivity versus industrialization, or can we think of a middle path, let's call it, in which agriculture receives the attention that it has failed to receive and certainly has merited, but we don't completely lose sight again of the need to diversify and industrialize?
Thanks, John. I hope it's okay that I start by saying that I don't actually think that Maggie and I, we disagree that much. I mean, the description Maggie was giving is pretty much correct, but it's not a description of what has happened since 1975, which is where I started. And I think that just needs to be kept in mind when you sort of think about the long-run historical developments and then what's happening more recently. I am myself among those who actually am incredibly encouraged about what's going on. I very much agree with Governor Ndulu that we should not underestimate that from somewhere around 1995, I mean, we can argue a lot about the exact date and so on, but somewhere around 1995, things have been on a very different track. So, John, how do I sort of make the two sides of my life, how can I say, hang together, if you wish? Well, I mean, I should maybe say that we are actually launching, from the wider side, another book next week in Stockholm, which is exactly on agriculture and poverty and how that sort of... So there are sort of two legs involved here. If you look very carefully at the Ethiopian experience and why Ethiopia has been doing well over the last number of sort of 15, 20 years, I mean, this is going back to discussions that we've had in development economics about agricultural development-led industrialization. And we've had senior colleagues who have been trying to formulate approaches referred to as ADLI, so agricultural development-led industrialization. And there is still a lot of truth in that. It's still a fact that when the majority of the population is in agriculture, having a significant impact on poverty, you cannot just ignore agriculture. One of the core issues in the poverty story about Africa is that agricultural productivity has not been moving. Now, it's no wonder, it's no really big wonder to some extent, because what was the focus of the Millennium Development Goal Agenda, the MDG agenda? That was not about agricultural productivity. That was about social services. That was about education and health. I am not saying that education and health are not a good thing. After all, I am a university professor. But what I am saying is that those types of investments, they are long maturing. And it is not enough just to be healthy and have some education. You also need to have a productive agriculture. And that has not been attended to by the donors and by African governments. We are still very far from the attention declared as a goal in Maputo, of all places. But attention to agriculture is not in contradiction with attention to manufacturing. Manufacturing needs inputs. Those inputs come from agriculture. Markets for industrial products are in agriculture. So instead of sort of having sort of two worlds that are not hanging together, no, you want to have one integrated economy. Sure, over the longer run, it's very clear that the relative importance of agriculture should be declining and so on. But we are very far from that situation yet. And I really don't see this as either or. I see this actually as both and. And when you actually dig into some of the success cases, you will see that those cases that have done well, also in terms of industrialization, manufacturing and so on, are actually the cases that have paid attention to agriculture. So the two things go together. So that's how I would tend to respond. I don't think that sort of, when you're thinking about a coherent economy, that can be an either or. That is a comprehensive, and flows hang together.
Thanks, Finn. Well, now to Maggie for the last question. You and Governor Ndulu, in fact, were agreeing certainly on one point, which is that the recent dynamism in industry that you've identified very much serves a market which is a national and regional market in Africa, producing products that are in some sense appropriate to an emerging African middle class and rising per capita incomes across the board. These are the small and medium producers. Made in Africa is, if you like, somewhat large-scale export-oriented biased, and I'm grateful to Governor Ndulu for pointing out why one wants export-oriented manufacturing. But it seems to me that there's some scope here for an integrated industrial development strategy that would actually span, if you like, using some new and creative thinking, the range of small, medium, and large-scale enterprise. So I wonder if, just to wrap up before we go to the audience, Maggie, you could give us some thoughts about if you were given carte blanche to design an industrialization strategy that would incorporate both your concerns for what you call the in-between sector and our concerns for large-scale export-oriented manufacturing, what would be some of the key elements of such a program?
Okay. So before I answer that question, can I just, since you asked two very high-level policymakers here, I just want to make another point, two other points related to this. So, and I'm not going to talk about infrastructure. We all know it's important, and the World Bank did a report on Ethiopia that shows Ethiopia's sort of innovative strategy for financing infrastructure, including financial repression, which the World Bank did not totally denigrate. So,
that's new.
Production for domestic markets can save foreign exchange, and I would really love to see some estimates that we can leave about how large the scope for this type of manufacturing could be in Africa, whether it's for domestic markets or for export to regional markets. And I have in my head a model like the United States, where some countries, maybe like Tanzania or Ethiopia, specialize in manufacturing. Some other places, maybe like Rwanda and Kenya, specialize in more high-tech services. In any case, I think that when you're talking about infrastructure, you can actually link that to the kind of manufacturing that you do and the ability to finance infrastructure. But And the other point, which is going to get to my what I would do if I could. So I think this is a really important thing for us all to think about. And I'm not name dropping, I promise. But I had a conversation about this with Paul Krugman this week because I happened to go and give a talk at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this, we were talking about manufacturing versus services and what are good jobs or not good jobs. And I think he raised this issue, and I think it's true, and I've heard Danny Roderick say it too, that a lot of the reason manufacturing jobs in the United States are what we called good jobs has to do with institutional factors. So it's the unions, it's the health benefits, it's all these things that go with the jobs. It's not special to manufacturing per se. So if you take that and you think about Africa right now, what I would like to see let me just pick one thing, and Kapil, has it raised the issue of financing? I think it's really important. So guess what? Barclays is pulling out of Africa. Here is a huge opportunity for Africans to take charge of the banking system and get finance in the hands of the small African businesses and the large African businesses. And so that's one thing that would be part of the strategy. And the other thing that would be part of the strategy is recognizing the fact that we call it the informal sector, which has a negative connotation, but 50% of the people operating in these businesses report that they wouldn't take a full-time salary job if they were offered that job. So, I mean, I think it's coming up with a different way to recognize that these firms, you know, you don't just make jobs out of nothing. People are making the jobs for themselves, and we have to support the guys who have the jobs that they say they like, but they could use more help in terms of maybe insurance or access to finance. I mean, sorry, I'm rambling a bit, but Jamie Dimon, you know, who is the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, there was a very interesting interview with him on Bloomberg, the Africa Opportunity. And whatever you think of Jamie Dimon, he said, if we believe the Africa Rising narrative, we have to get finance into the hands of consumers and small African businesses. Small African businesses. He said it twice. And while I don't think, and he talked about buying up Barclays, and I would rather see, you know, the African Development Bank and the Tanzanian Government Bank work with the private sector and figure out who is it that can take these Barclays branches and turn them into to banks that will serve not just the large firms, but also the small firms with huge potential for productivity gains. Can I stop there?
Yes, you may stop there. Because as usual, I've never succeeded as a moderator in actually meeting these TikTok forms that they give us. But we did start 10 minutes late. I'm looking to my colleagues in the back to see if we can beg 10 minutes or do they need the room? That's the big question. Okay, then unless Governor Ndulu needs to leave, at which point he's certainly excused because I know he has a crowded schedule of meetings, what I propose is we take about 20 minutes to take questions from the floor. We'll take several questions. Please identify yourself and your affiliation as you ask the question, and then I will turn it over to the panel without even trying to coach them as to who might answer it. But let's take, say, 3 or 4 questions, get some answers, and then come back to you again. So I see a range of hands here. Let's start over here on the front right-hand side, at least on my side.
Hi, I'm Brigitte Harrington, and I own a business in Ghana called Golf War Limited. And it's a comment that I'm going to make, and then I'm going to ask for other comments. I listened to you all talk about the informal businesses and the fact that some kind of way taxes get avoided. Well, what my experience is I find that when foreign direct investment goes into the country and you establish a business and you follow all the guidelines, then the tax man keeps showing up on your door weekly. And so in America, we're accustomed to paying our taxes on time because we know that we don't want to get in trouble with the IRS. So one of our practices has always been to pay all of these taxes before they're due. But yet and still, they continue to show up and they harass us on a regular basis. And this has been going on for 10 years. And so finally, you get to a point where you say, okay, enough already. So I think that in considering, and with the thought leaders here, in considering what happens in terms of foreign direct investment, that perhaps that can be a subject that's discussed. And I'd like to hear your comments about that.
Thank you. I'm going to skip back to the other side. I see Richard Neufarmer there, so I'll pull favorites and let Richard speak.
Thank you. Great panel, folks. Richard Neufarmer with International Growth Center. The structure of international trade actually has changed rather considerably in the last 20, 30 years. And with the whole movement towards global value chains, trade and tasks and the like. And, of course, this rewards speed in terms of ports, in terms of crossing borders, power, finance. We've talked about those things. And actually, I think Africa has done very well. I mean, dwell times in Mombasa have gone way down, for example, or transit times through Kenya have gone way down. So that those sets of policy domains, I think, position the region rather well, and particularly on services. That too, is important. My question has to do more with tariffs and non-tariff barriers, sort of the old conventional agenda. So maybe there's a question actually to Maggie. She, when we talked about a growth strategy for the region, didn't mention tariffs. But if anything, we see in East Africa, at least, movements towards increasing tariffs, movements towards classifying intermediate inputs as consumer goods, or the sensitive product list is increasing, the ban on secondhand clothing, for example. Is this a concern, or is this being used strategically as a good element of industrial policy to promote growth?
Thanks, Richard. Now we'll come back over here. Yes.
Good morning. My name is Tola Kwa. I am with Smith Buckland and Associates. I am also a former graduate of the University of Ghana, so this is a topic that we discuss heavily in school. I wanted to talk to Dr. Kampor because he mentioned energy. So in Ghana, we have had the effects of climate change. Our major river, the Volta River, has dropped significantly so that only two of the six turbines of the 1,000-megawatt hydroelectricity plant is operational, and there has been little shifts to other cleaner, more green, energy sources. And that's one issue. The other issue is that the government maintains a complete monopoly on energy. So even though there are private energy companies in the country, they're not allowed to sell directly to consumers. They're only allowed to sell to the government, which then sells it overseas. So how do we fix this policy issue? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's just take one more. I see a hand in way back. I'm sorry to make you walk all the way back there. Yeah, on the left-hand side. Oh, here we go.
Thank you very much. Lawrence Freeman. I've been analyzing economic policies for Africa for about 25 years. I write for ER Magazine, and I work with the Lake Chad Basin Commission. I think the narrative of the Africa Rising was always flawed, because services, no matter how large a part of the GDP they are not equal to manufacturing, agriculture, and infrastructure, because they don't add physical value to the economy. And that's why you have such a shortage of manufacturing. It's actually a crime to have 2-3% for the African continent. The model that we do have, and you've pointed a little bit at it with Ethiopia, which could be a template for Africa, is also, if you look at Ethiopia and you look at China and the Silk Road, which is an infrastructure-driven approach. It's not an add-on. It's the water, energy, roads, rail, drive the economy and employ people and add the physical value. And I think that the financing for this, with the Silk Road Fund, with the AIIB, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, with the BRICS New Development Bank, and state credit is absolutely necessary for the financing. The private sector will never, ever finance the needs of infrastructure. My studies show that Africa needs about 1,600 gigawatts of electricity to live like we do in this room. And that'll never, ever be financed by the private sector. You have the Roosevelt model in this country of state financing. So I think we do have a model. I think we've been totally neglect on manufacturing and industry. We have not produced really one agro-industrial sovereign state yet in Africa, and that should be our goal. Thank you.
All right. Four very different questions, but let me return to the panel, and I think I'll start with Kapil, work our way along, but take Maggie before the governor so he gets the last word on this round of questions. So, Kapil?
Yeah, let me talk about energy and infrastructure. I think what I'd urge you to do, actually, is to take a look at the strategy for lighting up and power Africa that we are coming up with and will be launched next month again. There is a huge push towards alternative forms of cleaner, greener energy continent-wide. I mean, in fact, when we talk about powering and lighting up Africa, we say, you know, clearly hydro, coal, everything's got to go into the energy mix. But the question is, where is a lot of the new investment going to come from? And Africa has a lot of potential in solar, in wind, et cetera, and you do see a lot of investment going in there. But just to come back to the last speaker and this rather sort of, you know, firm opinion that private sector will not finance, we actually see a lot of private sector interest and investment in infrastructure in Africa today. I mean, not just African private sector, but global private sector. Just last week, we were on our tour of countries in Japan, Korea, and China with phenomenal private sector interest for financing, but a key requirement being, can you come up to us with quote-unquote bankable projects? If there are projects that are available which you have vetted for rates of return, et cetera, and done the preparatory work, and if some organization like the African Development Bank can have skin in the game, because there is, of course, risk aversion, and there is concern for going in cold into some countries where they'll not know, which they don't know too well. The private sector seems to be telling us very clearly that the new model of financing will not be just a public sector one, not be just a private sector one, but will be one where institutions like the World Bank, the African Development Bank might come in, provide some sort of investment, provide some sort of debt, might take an equity stake, might do some kind of a guarantee facility, and then the government and the private sector will come in. And there seems to be a lot of interest. So I wouldn't quite dismiss private sector out of hand. I do admit, however, you know, state capital, domestic resources, et cetera, are going to be extremely, extremely important going forward.
Thanks, Kapil. Finn?
Yeah, there's actually a link between the first and the last two questions. And let me try to be sort of maybe slightly provocative, just in the interest of at least making a point. There's a lot of attention, certainly in the donor community and the IMF and the World Bank, on insisting that African governments need to build up their taxation capacity, domestic taxation capacity. Now, it's hard to get taxes collected from a lot of the African businesses. And in many cases, in my view, you shouldn't even try. You should be focusing your attention on where it is that the bigger resources are sitting, and that's where you should really focus your attention. And then, in many cases, allow a much more gradual process of building up the taxation capacity. I'm all for helping strengthen the system and build it up slowly. But setting very demanding targets for exactly how much taxation you should collect domestically and so on can in some cases be counterproductive, and it leads to the kinds of situations that I mentioned for Ghana. Don't get me wrong, in the long run you will have to collect your taxation, but we are also talking about large-scale investments in relatively capital-intensive activities of natural resources where there is a lot of money, and we should not at all overlook the fact that when there is discussions about profit shifting and so on, this is not just some sort of hypothetical thing. At WIDA, we've just completed a study of 325,000 observations of enterprise transactions, and what comes out very, very strongly is the losers in this game are the poorer countries. So, yes, we are having other sources of financing than just trying to get the money out of the small, medium, or even sometimes the slightly bigger enterprises. So I would say that there's something there that we should think very carefully about. You must understand that I spent some time in a Nordic environment, and in a Nordic environment right now, foreign aid, for example, in the case of Denmark and Finland, is being cut by 50%, 50. So I'm spending part of my time to remind people that while there is a lot of potential in the private sector, there are lots of things that the private sector will not do unless the public sector manages to set frameworks and in many cases, go first. So I would strongly argue that it's important that that is not forgotten. On the second observation, Richard, I mean, one of the reasons for optimism regarding African countries and process on industrialization and so on is exactly what you're referring to in terms of the global value chains and so on. There are opportunities here, and those are exactly among the ones that we were having in mind when we were talking about push exports and so on. I leave the sort of tariff, non-tariff discussion to Maggie, but I could kick in there. And then lastly, being Danish, I mean, we have, of course, had a problem for a while with a country fellowman who has been refusing that climate change takes place at all. obviously, I don't agree with him. But I would like still to add that it's also important that we don't use climate change as an excuse too often, because oftentimes the actual underlying cause for something not working is actually not yet climate change. I hope you get the point. I mean, climate change is a long-run structural change process where things are happening over really long. So we need to focus on what's actually wrong. And the energy crisis in Ghana is not just about climate change, I can assure you. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Finn. Margaret.
I'll be brief. Richard, I think your question is a great question about the role of, you know, tariffs and non-tariff barriers. Two points. One is I believe the Ethiopian government, I know that's not in Southern Africa or Southeastern Africa, but I believe that they have done, they have used tariffs and bans on the raw skin exports in the leather industry. I think they've used industrial policy very wisely, and we might not like it, but their goal was to build up the industry, and it seems to be working. I don't know as much about the tariff structure, for example, in Tanzania, and I think a really important question, and I'm going to try to understand better what's going on, but for example, why is this Chemicote so successful? The one question that everybody asks me is, how is it that they're competing with Colgate? How can they do that? I don't know the answer, but I want to find out. And then the woman who raised the issue about taxation and foreign direct investment, I'm very sympathetic about, I'm very sympathetic to the resistance to taxation of small businesses. I think the government has to earn the right to tax the citizens, and if the government is providing the right services, then we should be paying the taxes. But I want to, when it comes to foreign direct investment, I want to emphasize something. This is from some work we're doing in, this is in Ethiopia, where we've been looking at the benefits of foreign direct investment to domestic firms. And the Ethiopian government's stated policy vis-a-vis foreign direct investment is that it wants FDI to help upgrade technologically the industries it enters into. And we do have evidence of this kind of technology upgrading and workers moving from foreign firms to domestic firms and these benefits playing out. And I think these results are really important, they're new, and I think that there's some resistance. There's a lot of resistance to foreign direct investment, I feel, in many countries on the continent. And I think if we can document some of the benefits other than taxes that come from these direct investments, I think it could play an important role.
Thanks, Maggie. Now, finally, the last word to Governor Ndulu, and then I'm afraid we will have to close because we've already exceeded our welcome. Benno?
Yeah, I think almost all questions have been picked. Maybe I'll just focus on one, on services. I think we tend to underestimate the importance of services in our economy, including, I must say, whenever we talk about 70% of African population in rural areas, there is always a presumption that everybody in rural areas is engaged in agriculture. Look at all the household budget surveys that have been done over time. Increasingly, there are lots of services that are actually being also offered even in that context. In our own case, even in the context of talking about Tanzania, context of earning foreign exchange, our number one foreign exchange earner is tourism. That's the services sector. It's bigger than all the commodities put together. All our six major agricultural commodities earn us about 800 million, but tourism earns us 2.3 billion. Transit trade, services, this is trade in services, earns out about another 1.1 billion, bigger than all the commodities put together. So, and not only that, look at some of the recent research. In fact, the poverty-reducing impact of services has tended to be much higher than even agricultural growth. There is work that has been done recently. So ultimately, anyway, the mature economies are much, much bigger in services than simply the physical part of it. I heard reference being made that these are all non-physical. I don't know whether non-physical means not important, but certainly I've just demonstrated for you some of the importance in some of those contexts. Of all trade has to be facilitated. All communication. Big growth in Africa now is telecommunications, mobile money, services. You know, it's just a whole range of these services. And technology now at the forefront is ICT, is information technology. That's what makes things happen. So just a plug in this case for services so that one doesn't leave the room feeling like services means something not valuable. Sorry.
Thank you, Benno. At this point, I need to offer some thanks, obviously, in the first instance, to our panelists, several of whom have given up a good deal of time in a very busy week to come and share with us their thoughts. Finn Tarp for having flown in and having to fly out again this afternoon. And Maggie for stimulating us to get into the 21st century and find a way of beaming her in. Mentioning that, I do want to sincerely thank my colleagues here at Brookings, both the AGI team and our ICT people, for having developed this marvelous technology on about 30 minutes' notice so that we could have her join us and share her thoughts with us. To Amadou and AGI for allowing us to develop this event, and to all of you for coming out and listening. And finally, of course, do, if you're at all inspired and want to hear the new story and read it on an airplane, avail yourself of a copy of the book as you go out. Thanks very much for coming.